The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by a businessman, cookery writer, the co-founder of Leon Restaurants and the Sustainable Restaurant Association, and he's also managing partner of Bramble Partners, investing in sustainable food businesses. He was appointed lead non-executive board member of the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs in March 2018, and, alongside his wife Jemima Lewis, has co-written the book Ravenous, about how we can get ourselves and our planet into shape. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Henry Dimbleby.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Well, it's lovely to have you on. First of all, I do this with every guest. I ask them about inspiration, because we're called the Inspired Minds podcast. What is inspiration? What has inspired you? What does it mean to you? And is it necessary?
Well, is it necessary is a weird question. Let's start with the others, and then maybe I can work out the answer to that from the other thing. So for me, inspiration is about the kind of thing that makes your mind come up with new and interesting thoughts. And I think that there are very different types of people. Obviously, there's no point in your podcast if everyone had the same answer to the question. But there are some people who I am amazed by, whose minds seem constantly to bubble up. They have an internal energy that is constantly creating new ideas, thoughts, grand schemes, products they want to make, businesses they want to start. My business partner in Leon, John Vincent, was very much like this. His mind was just, it was like a kind of bubbling volcano. It had an internal energy that kept bubbling up with extraordinary things. My mind is not like that. My mind, without stimulation, shuts down. I'm more like a fire. I need to feed it. I'm not a volcano with an internal source of energy. I have a fire and I need to feed it with wood. And what my mind does is put things together. It takes inputs from all over the place, and then tries to spot patterns, tries to put them together to come up with something a bit new. You know, Dali said, cleverness copies, genius steals. But I think what he meant by that was, how can you take things that are already out there, but put them together in a new configuration such that they look completely new? And that's how my brain works. And if I don't get that stimulation, I literally shut down. So I literally go into a slough and my brain just thinks, right, you know, like a fire, the ashes start to turn over and I become almost subconscious. And so that, you know, where does that inspiration come? For me, the primary source is people and lived experience. So it is tasting things, seeing things, talking to people, being in highly stimulating environments where you have smells and sights and sounds. And that provides energy. And then the second resource is reading and listening. So I'm a voracious consumer of mostly nonfiction podcasts, etc. But occasionally you have to have a reset. So occasionally I'll have to read. The last one I did was the Buddenbrooks. You have to remind yourself how the human mind works. And only fiction can tell you how the human mind works. But most of the stuff that I feed my brain with is either lived experience or nonfiction podcasts, blogs, Substacks, God help me, and other such wood to the fire.
Was John Vincent the inspiration for Leon? I mean, I'm thinking back to that time when you first started and you'd come out of management consultancy. Lots of things obviously come together in your life at this point, don't they? Because you've had the management consultancy training, you have immersed yourself in food straight out of university, you worked in a Michelin-starred restaurant. You were brought up in a family that valued food and took it really seriously. Did John Vincent come along at a serendipitous time, or do you think you were looking for somebody at that stage to ignite and to give you the inspiration?
No, funny enough, I always think my career has almost felt like a kind of series. There's a street in Munster that has the longest bar in the world, and it runs through all of the different pubs. It runs through more than one establishment, and you kind of stay in one bar and then you see that the one next door looks a bit better and you go to that. And my life, my career has slightly been going to the next bar. That looks fun, looks more fun in there. But definitely at that point, so I'd worked with John and we traveled a lot. And it was the classic business of we ate a lot of fast food and it was delicious Kentucky Fried Chicken that made you feel miserable. You know, this was back in 2004. So it was like a lot of very cold neon lit sandwiches, and there was nothing that you could eat that was food on the go. And so it started off just a very abstract conversation with John about, wouldn't it be nice if this was better? And then I was sent out to Japan in 2002 to work out there, and I was approached to be a partner at the consulting firm I was at, and I was like, I'm not interested in widgets, I'm not interested in business for its own sake, I'm interested in food. And as you say, my mother was a food writer. She was very sensual. She would run out on a beautiful kind of warm, when the spring days got warm, and feel the air with her fingers and say, oh, feel the air, isn't it beautiful? So I had kind of, the stuff was important to me. I realized that, and I rang John up and said, look, I'm thinking of leaving to go and set up that business that we talked about. He said, I'm leaving too, I'll do it with you. But then the creative process, it was very much the two of us, but there was definitely, as we got going, and we realized this probably a bit too late, he could close his eyes and see things fully formed. I had to kind of look at things and, you know, shuffle towards them in a slightly more pedestrian fashion than he did. He just had that extraordinary ability just to say, no, we should do, you know, I remember I'm saying, I know what we should do. We should do a fish finger wrap, because everyone has fish, you know, and it'll be the fillet of fish, but for good food, and this is how it'll be. And, you know, he just used to come up with three or four of those every day. He'd also say, I know another business that we should set up every day as well, which got quite irritating after a while when you're still trying to get the first one going. But I think there are those different forms of inspiration. And I think more recently, interestingly, so that's kind of creativity. I think there's also inspiration in terms of how you want to spend your time. You know, I've talked very much about the kind of creative process, about the human as creator, the human as a turning entropy into some organized form, and, you know, businesses and art, and that's all we're doing. We're using energy to remove entropy. But I think there's a kind of, now in my very advanced years, there's another form of inspiration. I studied physics and philosophy. I've always been an atheist. I've always been quite a kind of pragmatic, logical person. But I think there is definitely a sense in which recently, and partly through the work I've done on the food strategy, I get inspiration now in a very deep sense from nature that I didn't used to get. E.O. Wilson, who wrote the great work on the kind of how important biodiversity was, he talked about how nature settles your soul because it's beyond man's contrivance. And I definitely now, in a way that I, you know, when I was a child or even a young man, I wouldn't have got, I can now watch a couple of oyster catchers wading in the mud, and it gives me a really deep sense of satisfaction and peace. And that is a different form of inspiration. That's inspiration as the kind of receiver of, you know, being in tune with your environment, rather than the inspiration of constantly being wanting to change it, wanting to make it better, wanting to create something bigger and better. That kind of inspiration that is just to the soul, I think, is something I think a lot of people get into gardening and birds when they get older. There's obviously something that happens genetically, but it's definitely a very different kind of inspiration.
Well, it feels to me like you've had that in you for quite some time. Perhaps it might be more urgent now or more salient, perhaps. But when I think back to the start of Leon, there was something kind of elemental about it, and there was something family about it. So remember your first couple of restaurants you opened, there was a lot of references or pictures of family, you know, be that you as children growing up, but they were always in places like, you know, seasides or fields or somewhere outdoors. And the very sort of branding of Leon with the orange with the, you know, the stick sticking out of it. So this wasn't a supermarket orange that you just picked up and had no connection to the nature. It was almost like Leon was trying to remind you the food you get comes off a tree, you know.
Funny enough, so that's how we talked about it. So it was a very sensual thing. We talked about Leon as like one of the things that it should do. One of the observations was that modern life was all the same. Every high street was the same. Every day was the same. You're just repeating, looking at your phone, getting onto the tube, getting off the tube, going home. not watching Netflix in those days, but whatever it was we used to watch before Netflix. And we talked about connecting people to nature and connecting people to the rhythms of life. So actually, you know, that, I guess that what I hadn't thought about that, there was a frost in Spain. We opened in 2004. I think it was spring 2005, maybe 2006. And there was a particularly wicked frost, a bit like the one we had, the cold snap we had last year. Price of veg went up, almost doubled. We were like, oh my God, we're selling our salads at a loss. And we had to put a pound on the price of them. And we put up a little note saying that there's been this frost in Spain. It was better than any bit of marketing we'd done. People really loved the idea. They, oh, wow. Oh, that's interesting. You know, you told the story. So, yeah, maybe it was around longer than I had thought. I mean, the places and stuff, that's always, I mean, you know this. I'm never happier than cooking for people, creating a space where people can enjoy themselves. So that sense of family, you know, we always used to talk about the best parties were the ones that at midnight, your granny was dancing on the dance floor with the babies and, you know, someone had barbecued a huge thing and the wine had flowed freely, and that sense of not being judged and just spaces where you could be yourself, that's just something I naturally gravitate towards.
You've mentioned that you did physics and philosophy at university. I wonder how much this is sort of speaks to an ongoing conversation that happens in your mind, because one of them is very much, I mean, you're probably going to tell me that they're actually both about ideas. But one of them feels to be more sort of practical problem solving, and another one appears to be slightly more open to the argumentative process. You know, in moral philosophy, there isn't a truth. There's a whole bunch of different ideas, whereas in a mathematical equation, there is a truth at the end of that. So is that something that is helpful to you, or is it just reflective of the fact that you have two very different ways of looking at things?
I think it is definitely a theme. If I look at what I've done, that yin and yang is definitely a theme throughout my life. So trying to be both creative and logical, both being quite law-abiding, but also now being completely childishly ridiculous. If I'm stopped by a police officer, I can't, you know, so like that kind of both trying to live within the system, follow the rules, work out how the rules work, and at the same time trying to be more spiritual and escape it. That is definitely something that's kind of, and that's like Leon, I think one of the reasons it worked was that we, you know, it took a long time to get it to work, but that it had that emotional attachment. It had an emotional hit that was much bigger than just the food that it served. It meant something to people. But also behind the scenes, there was this, you know, I worked in Burger King for a few days. We learned as much as we could. The systems behind it were incredible. It had to be to produce decent food at a price that's relatively regularly tasty is a massive logistical and engineering feat. So I think that definitely has been, you know, and I think part, you know, in the food strategy and Ravenous, the book, that thing of the logic, the kind of simultaneous equation of how do we produce enough nutritious food to feed people and sequester carbon and restore biodiversity. It's a mathematical solution to an equation. How do you combine that with the awe people feel in nature, the beauty and the sense of connection that even people who live in cities have to the British countryside? You know, I quite enjoy trying to reconcile those two sides of the human experience.
Well, it's really noticeable in reading Ravenous that there is passion and logic in equal measure. I mean, it's a brilliant page-turning experience, because one minute you're assailing us with facts, really quite bizarre facts. I had no idea that in the 1950s, we thought we were never going to have enough food to feed everybody until an inspirational man comes along. Nor, although I kind of suspected it, did I realize just how much the weight of people has changed. You have in there three wonderful graphs, one in the 1950s, one in the, well, it said in 1950, one in 1980, and one basically the present day, 2020. And the first two are bell curves, which just instinctively makes sense, even to somebody like me who didn't study science, it just makes sense that would be how the weight distribution of people would go. And in 1980, that bell curve is a little bit further over. It's a BMI bell curve, isn't it? A body mass index. So by the time we get to 1980, it's actually exactly the same shape, only everybody's a little bit heavier. Not desperately so. There's not a huge amount of morbid obesity, but it's all moved over. And in some senses, for the better, because you've now got fewer people who are underweight, but you do have slightly more people who are overweight. Then you hit us with the 2020 thing. And I call it a thing because it's not suddenly a bell curve. It's just this horrible distribution of knobbles.
It looks a bit like the blob in that B movie from the...
Yeah.
And it's stretched out to the right. So basically, what's gone on is that this food system that we exist in has become more and more, we call it the junk food cycle. The food companies have hacked into our ancient appetite. The hypothalamus, where our appetite is regulated, is one of the most ancient bits of evolution. We have no idea really how it works. It evolved before you and I split from the lugworms that sit in the mud that those oyster catchers are walking in. So they have a hypothalamus too that's very similar to ours. It is just way more powerful. We all like to think that we are self-determining beings, but our lusts and appetites, as any novelist knows, are way more powerful than we think. And the food system has just been engineered, because that's how you make more money, to attract us to the foods that feed into this appetite, these appetites that evolved when calories were very scarce. And as a result, those with the kind of genes most susceptible to it, that kind of stretches out like a tongue to the right-hand side. Now they're sucking people into really serious, the most extreme case, someone with Prader-Willi syndrome, which Katie Price's son has, incidentally. That gives you no feeling of satiety at all. You don't ever get full, and you will go to 80 or 90 BMI. Obese is 30, so you're three times the weight of someone who's got a 30 BMI, and then you die. And you literally have, with those people, you have to keep them physically away from food. But then there's a gradation of appetites that are becoming more and more susceptible to these things. And so, you started talking about the book and the kind of the rational and the passionate. The passionate, fun enough, it comes on me in bursts. My wife, Jemima Lewis, who was the co-author of the book, we had our first child, George. Mima had a really medieval labor. We sort of started with all of the birthing pool and the playlist and all of that. The birthing pool never got full. Our midwife at home, she said that my wife might have two cervixes, and I thought it was time to go to hospital. She didn't. Just a bad midwife. And then 24 hours later, George came out, and it was just unbelievably physically shattering experience for Mima, and emotionally quite a rollercoaster for me. And then we went out a few days later, first time we emerged, we went out into the park, London Fields, beautiful spring day. All these people just like walking around, some pushing prams, like parents with their older children. And mine was like, how can all these people, they know what happens in there. How can they all be walking around, like not talking about it? And that's what I felt about the food system sometimes. Like you look at the numbers and then you go, oh my God, this thing is the biggest cause of biodiversity collapse, second biggest cause of climate change, biggest cause of deforestation, biggest cause of freshwater pollution, second biggest cause of climate change, biggest by far cause of avoidable ill health. It's going to bring down the NHS and the economy. And no one's talking about it. So I'm normally quite a rational person, but then it's a bit like, Soylent Green as people, and then I worry I'm going to get chucked into the back of a van and driven off, but you kind of feel that you have to say something. Will your listeners understand that reference?
Yeah, well, I hope so. Yes. Well, if they don't, they'll
Google it.
Yeah, that's because we have good self-teaching, autodidactic listeners here on Inspired Minds. Now, the reason for mentioning those graphs, though, is because you put them in early in the book. You don't lay it on with a trowel, but anybody with half a brain can see this and think, hang on, this is a system that in the last 40 years has got rid of, actually, agency. I mean, this is something that you don't put it quite like that, but you mentioned it already here, that we like to believe that we have agency over our lives and that it's about self-discipline. And particularly obese people, I think, get a really bad rap in this respect. You see somebody who's overweight and you think, well, that's entirely their fault because it's very simple. You just eat less, don't you? Well, if that were the case, then this graph wouldn't look like this, would it? Because obviously this is a function of people doing their damnedest, actually, not to succumb to the food system and failing. Otherwise, you'd just have another bell curve, wouldn't you? But just further along and with a higher BMI. So you're dealing with a world that knows that there's something horribly wrong and is really struggling. So that must be quite dispiriting because you're sort of dealing with a system that's absolutely stacked against us.
Yeah, and there are two ways to treat it. It's a malfunctioning feedback loop. It's what's known as a reinforcing feedback loop, which is like an escalating feedback loop. So I start talking louder, you start talking louder, I talk louder, and then we're shouting at each other. And that's what's gone on, which is we like the bad stuff. The companies spot that's how they can make money. They put more money into researching and marketing it. We eat more, they spend more, we eat more, they spend more. And now 85% of the foods sold by the big, fast-moving consumer goods companies are deemed to be too unhealthy to market to children. Because it's a feedback loop between appetite and commercial incentive, you can tackle the commercial incentive. And that's what we talked about in the food strategy. And you speak to all the CEOs of the supermarkets, consumer goods companies. They're saying there's nothing we can do. If we don't sell this stuff, someone else will. We don't want to kill our customers. We're as stuck as everyone else is because we'll just get fired if we don't sell chocolates unilaterally. And so you could try and tackle that. You can ban advertising. You can put tax on things. The other thing you can do is you can change the appetite. And that 3 or 4 years ago would have seemed like science fiction. But obviously, as all your listeners will know, we now have the first of what will be a huge swathe of appetite suppressing drugs. Semaglutide, sold as Wegovy and Ozempic. And there are 4 or 5 that are due to be cleared. One's a pill. And so I think that that is how what the protection that we might get is the drug. And then what that looks like, I was speaking to a partner in a consulting firm who's in the States. He was saying all of the people who are making those products, chocolate, sweets, ready meals, they are all seeing already the effect that Ozempic's having. And they think there's nothing they can do about it. They think they're going to lose a lot of money. Good. The pharmaceutical companies are all, suddenly all of this profit from food is going to become our profit because we're going to sell the drugs. Literally, the profit moves. They buy our product. They don't buy a Mars bar. They buy a jab. And the only company, the only business who is thinking we actually need to change the system are the insurers, because the insurers in America pay either way. They either pay for you to have your leg amputated because you've got diabetes, or they pay for the drug, but either way they pay. So he was saying that the only people who really want to kind of think about systems change are the insurers. And when you see it that simply, it's kind of completely undeniable.
Inspirational, one might almost say, because when I think back to the genesis of Ravenous, the book, and indeed the food strategy, you weren't aware of the systemic issues in the food system, were you, right at the beginning of starting Leon? But I suppose in having to deal with manufacturers and seeing where your food came from, that would have come more sharply into focus. But it then sends you off into so many different tangents, because this isn't an easily digestible equation, is it? This is an extremely complicated one in which you've got so many different factors inputting, and yet they're all connected, but there's not easy to break any single one of them. When did you become sort of aware of the sheer magnitude of the complexity?
Well, I think there are two steps. When did I become aware of the scale of the problem? Because initially when I started it, there was a bit of work done by a bunch of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, often lobbying organizations. We spend just over $100 billion on food in this country, and they had quantified that it was the cost of that food that wasn't paid at the counter. So the cost to the environment and NHS costs and people being out of work, productivity costs, was about the same cost as the food itself. And I looked at it and thought, yeah, right. This is lobbyists, just they've picked the highest number, added a bit more spin, and then doubled it. One of the first things we did is we really dug down into those numbers, and I became convinced that actually it was an underestimate. And so that was an amazing team in DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, really digging down into the numbers. And that was quite scary. I suddenly realized, but there are two big transitions. We have to go through the energy and transport transition, but the food transition is the other thing that's going to destroy society if we don't deal with it. And then the complexity, one of the unbelievable privileges of doing a government review is anyone will take your call. You can literally Google and think, who are the cleverest people in the world who can talk about this? And then you can ring them up and talk to them. And it was just a lot of the work we did was through COVID. And so you could get them on a Zoom. And so we spent quite a long time getting the real experts from around the world talking about how on earth you deal with these complex situations. And you'd literally have a kind of a Zoom call with Laszlo Barabasi, incredible network physicist from America, on it, you know, with Kevin Hall, who did all of the brilliant experiments, who first worked out that ultrapressure freedom might be a problem. You'd have all these people who you had brought together, and you'd sit back and listen to them talking about it. And that was incredible. But it also kind of created a really strong view about what a lot of people said, you need to use systems theory. And you're like, great, we'll do systems thinking. Oh, you need to do it. We'll do that. And then you go, what is it? And then they say, like, what is, how do you do that then? And they're like, they give you like 15 different answers. But the bunch of people who've done systems theory in engineering, in ecological systems, in, funny enough, where it emerged in MIT in the 50s, in business, it was one of the few sciences that's gone from being a business studies thing with the invention of computers to manage, look at how supply chains break down. And now it's being used to look at how light is recycled into energy and ecological systems and how they break down. But basically, that was a system is full of feedback loops, and there are different kinds of feedback loops. There can be dampening feedback loops, escalating feedback loops, etc., etc. Systems break down in similar ways. There are ways in which systems break down, either because they don't have the requisite stable feedback loops, or because something like the junk food cycle and escalating feedback loop happens. And what you need to do in a system is you need to identify what those feedback loops are. And there are two in the food system. There's junk food cycle and the visibility of nature. And then you have to try and act to fix those. But really, and this is the bit politicians hate, the other thing you know about complex systems is no one can say for sure what is actually going to happen when you do that, because systems respond in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways. A great example for me is the sugary drinks levy. Do you remember there's a George Osborne in the budget put a tax on the amount of sugar in drinks? And it has been enormously effective at getting sugar out of soft drinks, but it doesn't seem to have reduced in total the amount of sugar we're consuming. And I got a letter from one of the big sugary drinks companies during the food strategy saying, we strongly support the extension of the sugary drinks levy to all sugar. And I was thinking, why are they making that? Like, why are they making this there? Why do they care? And then I realized that what this sugary drinks had done is it had shrunk the balloon, but our desire for sugar had been pushed out into confectionery and milkshakes and other things. And so the drinks companies wanted to level the playing field. They'd realized they had lost share of sugar. So, you know, you never know what you have to, you know, kind of the hopefulness. I don't think that is a reason to give up. So that's a lot of politicians go, it's too complicated. I give up. But actually, you can. There's all sorts you can do, and you need to continue to try and experiment and work out what works.
You tackle that in a way in the book when you describe how governments want evidence-based policymaking, which on the face of it sounds absolutely what we want. We don't want to spend money on policies that don't have good evidence for their success. But by the same token, you also point out that this system is so complicated that actually, this was a private company, you'd be doing trial and error and seeing what works. And you refer to a guy in Finland. Is he called Pushka?
Pekka Puska.
Sorry, I beg his pardon. Pekka Puska. It's one of the many great bits in your book, because we go back to the 1950s, don't we? Or even earlier. And this fella trying a whole variety of different things to see what works. And things do work, but he doesn't know which ones are going to work before he tries them. Is that a fair summation?
Pekka, this was back in, it was actually the late 60s, early 70s, and Finland had the highest rates of heart disease in the world. Men were dying at kind of late 40s. They thought there were a number of causes to this. A lot of them had taken up smoking during the war, and they'd come back and smoked a lot. They hardly ate at all. They were seen as fodder for animals. And so the basic their diet, particularly in North Karelia, where he started up in the north of Finland, was basically meat and butter and water. The guy who hired Pekka Puska, who was a young doctor at the time, said he got so fed up with people coming to Finland and trying to work out why they were the most unhealthy people in the world that they had to do something about it. And he hired this young doctor because Pecker went on to become the head of the health service, but they hired him when he was young because they thought it would take a long time to fix. And he decided that he had to do everything. He's an amazing man. He talked about getting your feet deep in the mud. So he said, okay, we've got the problem of diet, problem of exercise, problem of smoking. These are all why we're dying of heart disease. And he did everything. So on exercise, he gave old people snowshoes so they could exercise in the winter. He lit snow paths so that you could exercise at night, obviously very, very long nights in the winter. They created cooperatives to freeze berries in the summer so that everyone could have berries in the winter. They worked with the sausage manufacturers to put mushrooms into the sausages. They created a cookbook and then went round and taught all of the people how to cook what was known as Pusker's stew, which was put vegetables into your stew. The most popular television program amongst Finnish males was a program where people from different villages competed to see who could be the fittest, like who could be the most healthy. And they did all of this stuff. And it was an amazing success. But he was criticized by some scientists because they said, how can we work out what worked? How do we know what to repeat? And he was like, I couldn't wait. I just did it. Now, interestingly, in the UK government, in the last 4 years, 5 years, can't remember what it was, 4 years ago, it was when I was the lead non-exec in Department for Rural Food and Rural Affairs, Cabinet Office set up a thing called the Evaluation Task Force, because something like 60% of government spend is never evaluated. And that is that's a big deal. That's really important. So what we should be doing is, rather than waiting for double blind trials to start to do something, recognize that we do all sorts of stuff that may or may not be good, but we don't measure the outputs. So we should be spending much more time, my view, measuring up outputs. I hope that, you know, in 5 years' time, at the moment, you cannot find that information. In 5 years' time, there should be a government website where anyone can go on and they can see an evaluation of anything that's been done, because that is what you need to do. Otherwise, if you wait for evidence to act, then you don't act. So you need to have evidence-informed policy, not evidence-based policy, but then you need brutally to evaluate the evidence. Obviously, politicians don't particularly like that because they shouldn't be. They should recognize, like all of us, that they don't really know what their policies are going to do. But that's not obviously the mindset of most politicians. And in fact, it's a real Michael Gove, not everyone's favorite politician, who set up the ETF. And it's a tribute to him that he was prepared to leave this thing. His legacy from government might actually be the fact that we work out how we're spending everyone's money and how we can spend it more carefully.
Now, just give us an insight into what it was like to make that transition from being an entrepreneur running your own business, trying your own things, trying and failing sometimes, trying and succeeding in other times, to having to work with government. Because I remember the amount of time and the effort that you put into the food strategy, and then it has to get delivered somehow. You have to hand your baby over and then hope against hope that it's not going to get battered by the winds of political fate, doesn't it? That must be psychologically quite a difficult thing to be doing.
Interestingly, because I'd done the school food plan earlier under the coalition government, and the condition that I'd given for doing that with John Vincent, who I mentioned at the start of the podcast, was that we would negotiate the policy. So we'd publish it not as an independent review, but as a set of policies. I was very well aware that one of the things that could happen, that happens to most independent reviews, is that they are used as a shield to prevent action, and then nothing happens and they gather dust. But that wasn't going to be possible with this, because it's such a big issue. There is no way that you could agree all the policies. So I intentionally did two things. Intentionally told a story, which is the story of Ravenous as well, because you can't make any change unless you have a consistent story. And the story, I think, has been really become very well embedded, both in the government departments and in the Labour Party. Very few people now say it's your own fault for being so lazy. They recognise the limitations of agency. And then the second is policies. Now, the policies that I gave, the Tory party broadly did doing all of the stuff on environment, and they went backwards on health. So Boris Johnson, at one point when he thought he was going to die because of his weight, for a fleeting moment said he was going to do lots of stuff, and then he didn't. But they're there. The policies are there. So I kind of, people come up to me and go, oh, you poor thing. You know, oh, I'm so sorry that they didn't do what you said they'd do. And I'm like, no, actually, they've done half the stuff in environment and it's still there. That's not the game. The game is a long-term game. So I'm not so worried about that. I think they're fascinating. It was fascinating going from entrepreneurial existence to seeing how government works and seeing the interaction between politicians and civil service and seeing I served under five secretaries of state in my 5 years and four prime ministers. And broadly, I'd have kind of two observations on the working of the whole system, which is, well, three maybe. First of all, you know, you said really rightly that in business, you do trial and error a lot. You try a lot of things that fail. And then if they fail, you try something else. And then you hit on something that succeeds. That is, politics is very bad at that. It's very, very against failure. And that's a problem. I don't know how you change that, but that's the first observation. The second observation is that the civil service, watching how they operate, is pretty awe-inspiring. There are some incredible people doing something I think to most people would drive you insane. We all have kind of views about what is right and what is wrong, and yet they have to remain completely apolitical, and watching them pivot from the whims of one Secretary of State to deliver what another Secretary of State does under the extraordinary leadership of a woman called Tamara Finkelstein was just awe-inspiring. I think there are things that are structurally wrong with the civil service in that it's very hard to, because of the way it's so structured, it's very hard to keep people in one place. It's very hard to pay the people. There are some people who just work unbelievably hard and they get paid the same and treated pretty much the same as someone who just, and there are quite a lot of people who just come in and clock out. So you feel sometimes when you watch them, God, it's so unfair. There's like this cadre of absolute Spartans or whatever. I don't know what they're kind of, and they are dragging this whole organization with them, which seems very unfair. So that's second, the civil service is a pretty amazing thing. And it's structurally, its problems are all structural. I'm not sure there's anything you can do about them. They're in the nature of it. The third thing is skills that it takes. It is possible to be an effective Secretary of State. It is possible to bring the civil service with you. People complain the civil service holds them back. It's possible to bring them with you. But the skills that it takes to do that, which are a combination of visionary thinking, unbounded positive energy, and a real attention to detail, are not the kinds of things that are necessarily rewarded by the party system. And so the number of Secretary of States and the number of people who have that combination of skills is very slim. And it makes me worry about, you know, how horrific it is to be an MP, because we really need to attract good people into it. And it's just not a profession that sane, talented people are going to be particularly interested to go into. So if you ever get a chance, if you worked in the state sector and you ever, a private sector, you ever get a chance to go and do a bit of service in the public sector, I strongly, it's fascinating, and you just meet incredible people who get paid almost nothing and keep this country running. It's amazing.
A couple of things to finish off on. The very high profile things. I can't believe I've left it till this time to talk about, really. You had dealings with Marcus Rashford and you're also involved in Chefs in Schools. So for you, both the supply of free school meals, especially to needy pupils, but also giving the skills and the expectation, I guess, of good food to children is a really important part of the whole strategy, isn't it? You've got to sort of start somewhere, and you start as young as you can.
Yeah, I think that you need the regulation. It is necessary to restrict the profits that companies can make and make it easier to make money doing things that are good rather than toxic. But it's not sufficient. Like, you need also to inject a huge amount of care into it. Like, every food, plate of food that's cooked for another human is done, that's delicious and nutritious, done because someone cares. Our food culture is critical, and that all starts in schools. That is really what we're doing with Chefs in Schools. We are training school cooks, helping them on a budget cook better food and do better food education. But the Marcus Rashford thing is, you know, that's another very surreal moment, because that came about, he had been campaigning for free school meals. And the reason it's so important is not just because you're providing meals to those in poverty. The cutoff level is still outrageous. It's £7,400 household income before benefits. That's what you have to be on in order to get free school meals. So that's outrageous. But actually, by going to a kind of more universal provision, you provide the financial clout so that you can cook really good food in schools. And the Rashford thing was, again, during that first year of lockdown, he had been campaigning for free school meals, just for those specific holidays. And I had written the first part of the food strategy, and I happened to know Ed Woodward, who was the CEO of Manchester United at the time. Kind of on a whim, I emailed the part one to Ed and said, will you give this to Marcus Rashford? And he might be interested. And I literally never thought I'd, you know, that was it. And then Marcus's team got in touch in September. He's an incredible, really impressive young man. He started this task force, got all the supermarket CEOs to come to, and others to come to a meeting, which I then sat in and had to tell them, you know, why this was important and what they were doing. And then got those CEOs to campaign for this in their supermarkets. And in October 2020, that year, over that half term, the government agreed, thanks to his pressure, to give free school meals in perpetuity during the summer holidays with other classes, during all the holidays, to people living in poverty. So that was a complex system. It was a case of pulling a lever and an unintended result.
And is this a massive exaggeration to start with, that British school children may have food like French school children? I don't know if this is true, but you keep on saying, you know, I saw the other day a school in the south of France, and there's sort of three courses, and there's always like a consommé, there's a sort of duck, and everyone knows what else. I mean, that's something that seems to be so ingrained in that country's culture. Is it possible to change a whole country's food culture?
Yes, and if you want to, and if you know anyone who is interested, we will set up a lunch for you at a chefs in schools school. So what people say is, we work mostly with schools with very high free school meals, so we prioritise schools in tough areas. And people say, oh, you know, it's impossible to do it at that budget. It's impossible to get the kids to eat it. They don't want this Ottolenghi food. They just want their chips. Not true. It's really hard because you're creating a culture, and as the French thing is about culture. But if you go into a school, it's different for secondary and primary. So, but let's talk about secondary because it's harder. If you go into a school, you don't tell them that it's healthy. That's the first disaster. You make the better food more popular. You do it like you start with doing a barbecued jerk chicken and it runs out. And then gradually you change the palate and you move away. I can take you to a school in really tough estate in North London where they are having a salad bar with salad picked from their own things. They're having their own home fermented chili sauce. The teachers are all eating with the children, and it looks like something out of France, and they love it. It takes about 3 years, and you have to be careful, but you have to create the culture. It just is possible to change. If you think about our food culture, you know, when we were growing up, we had the worst food culture in the world. We now have the restaurant and better restaurants. Undeniably, everyone except the French, and actually even the French now are sending their chefs to the UK to train, thinks that we have better food than them. So you can change culture. You just have to be prepared to do it and not be defeatist about it. It is amazing to watch some of these schools and what the school chefs are doing and the education they're getting. It used to be viewed, I think it's not anymore, it used to be viewed like food was something that you thought about if you weren't serious about maths or teaching English. And yet every single school that you go to that's got really good maths and English pretty much all look after the food as well because they just care about the children. So that makes me pretty angry, the idea that no one would just not want to feed their own children well. Well, if it's the state and you've got the children in your care, you should feed them well and give them an education that sets them up for life.
My last question to you, Henry, is about legacy, really. Does legacy matter to you? Is it an inspiration to you to think of what you might have left behind? Because, you know, you've left on the high street a very visible, and more than the high street, all over the country. You and John Vincent's creation, Leon is there. It's very physically there. But the things that you've gone on to do after that are of much more importance, really. They tackle a systemic problem that involves health, it involves the environment. I mean, they're massive issues for the 21st century. Is legacy an important thing for you?
I don't know if legacy is quite a word for it. You know, as a physicist, I'm aware that
heat death of the universe.
At some point in the future, the universe is going to be a fully entropized, low vibrating waves. So in that sense, it's all futile. There are two things I'd say. One is that I'm very bad at taking stock. I'm always thinking, right, that's done. It's not good enough. What am I going to do next? You know, I've got a kind of itchy slightly driven personality. And so that doesn't lead itself to really thinking about legacy. It leads itself to thinking, am I doing something important now? But I do, the one thing that gives me pleasure in my career, I do look back at the things that I've done. There are obviously loads of people involved. I wasn't sufficient, but I was necessary. So I look back at universal free school meals for all infants, and I think, well, that was not a bad thing. It might have happened sooner or later, but the fact that it's happening now is me. I look back at Leon. I actually think Leon was much more powerful in terms of the change it created outside of the restaurant itself, but it changed certain attitudes. Yeah, so I kind of look back at things and think, that was all right. I look back at Ravenous, the book, and the food strategy. I think there's some good ideas in there that will percolate into society for a bit.
But just to be clear, is it important to be doing important things? And I ask that because you know full well what I do, and I would struggle to label it as important.
I think you're unique in that you have found your ikagi, as the Japanese people say, which is the thing that takes your pleasure, your purpose, and you manage to make money from it through whatever incredible twist of fate you've managed to do that. For me, I think it's a psychological disorder brought upon probably by ambitious parents and, you know, et cetera, feelings of insecurity. But yes, much as I have to feed my mind to get inspiration, I have to move forward. I have to constantly be moving forward. I'm very bad at sitting still.
Like a shark. Henry, thank you so much for joining us on Inspired Minds. You've given me plenty of food for thought, and your book, Ravenous, alongside Jemima Lewis, your wife, is an absolutely stunning read. It feels like it's going to be hard work, and it isn't. You told me it was written with your 16-year-old son in mind, and that's very helpful for me. It's allowed me to gobble it up. It's truly spectacular effort.
It's like Pringles. Once you start, you can't stop. That was the idea. Once you pop, you can't stop.
What a perfect note on which to finish. Henry Dimbleby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Henry Dimbleby. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms, and if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.